I'm so happy you folks are here today, and we will do our best to share what wisdom we have gathered, the four of us. Jordan's eye roll. I thought for fun we would start by each of us introducing ourselves, and then my esteemed co-panelists have all sent me one audio clip that they love. And I said, I don't care what it is, why you like it, just be ready to tell us why, and a little bit of a heads up. So why don't we just start and go down the row? Amy, can I put you on the spot? Let me make sure I have the right one. It's Melinda, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you want to set that up?
Yeah.
Oh, and you need a microphone here.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
All right, so this is Melinda Jenke. She's an attorney in Guyana who is a big, like, character in our current drill season, which is looking at Exxon's offshore drilling there. And the reason I picked it is because I think it's a good example of why, for me, it's really important to spend a very long time with any community I'm reporting on. So in this case, we had a reporter in Guyana that was working with us for 2 years. I went there twice for a pretty extended period of time, and when I was talking to Melinda about the issue of a lot of environmental groups in particular saying, oh, you know, we need to allow the global south to develop fossil fuels for longer, she had this response that totally changed the way that I think about this issue, which I think is the thing that you, you know, see happen when you report on communities that you're not part of. So,
great.
Yeah,
that's it. We'll play it, and then you'll tell us a little more about you after.
Okay. Developing countries should have until 2050 to come away from oil. Why would you say that when in every single former colony people are saying stop the oil, we don't want it? You know, they're putting their lives on the line to stop oil. And you sit in your comfortable university room and say, oh, well, I've decided that in the interest of justice, these people shouldn't have to get rid of fossil fuels until 2050.
I can't really hear it because we were having lunch.
It's audio. Tough.
Audio lesson number one. Don't record over lunchtime.
Oh, should I
tell us
myself?
Okay, I'm Amy Westervelt. I'm a climate journalist. I was a print journalist for a long time. Then I started doing radio maybe about 10 years ago. And then as part of doing radio, it's like a lot of people here know, you get so much tape and you'd only use 4 minutes of it. And it made me sad that all the stories were cut out. So I started making podcasts. And then in 2017, actually, when I started making podcasts, I was like, why is every climate podcast just two people talking to each other about science or policy? Why is there no narrative in climate podcasts? And then I started trying to come up with an idea for one, and I realized why, because it's really hard to come up with, like, the right idea. So it took me a couple of years, but I was reporting on climate cases in San Francisco, and I was in a courtroom where the judge had ordered a climate science tutorial, and I was like, this is it. I'm going to do a true crime podcast about climate change. So I started a podcast called Drilled, and then that led to, like, multiple other podcasts, all in the sort of, like, climate narrative realm.
Can I say something real quick?
Sure.
One of the reasons we were really happy to have Amy join us is she's basically built a network of podcasts that she can now cross-promote across and partner with other producers, and so I think her perspective is going to be really helpful in the conversation when we talk about distribution and stuff like that.
Yes, yes, thank you.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, so the clip we're about to hear is from a man named Pat Kinneen. He's a fifth-generation Butte miner in Butte, Montana. And he also spent a lot of time as a natural resource specialist, sort of looking at a lot of the damage that mining, both underground and open pit, in Butte had caused in his hometown. And this is when he's telling a story from his childhood in the 60s or 70s about what a certain creek was like in the valley of the town, because Butte is on a hill right next to the Continental Divide and the Rocky Mountains, and there's this creek that runs right below it.
But that's not exactly how Pat remembers it. When he was a kid, he and his buddies used to take a shortcut home after baseball games and hop on a pipeline over the creek.
And when your buddy would get out there on the pipe, you'd start throwing rocks at him, trying to knock him off. So eventually, you know, we all got knocked off the pipe, and you'd end up in the creek, and about 2 days later, your shoelaces are gone, and about a week later, your shoes are gone, because you fell in the creek, and it was full of acidic mine water.
Okay, so I shared that, I gathered that tape many years ago now, and I think it's still my favorite because after all the reporting I've done on hazardous waste cleanups in Butte and the water quality issues and the soil issues and environmental health issues, nothing has stuck like this guy talking to me about being in a kid falling in the creek and having the acid destroy his shoes. And I just feel like that's someone who's lived it and really cares about the issues there. And that imagery will do more than like a 1,000-page wonky super fun cleanup document ever will. My name's Nora Sachs. I'm a podcast producer at WBUR in Boston, but I live in Maine. I'm also an instructor at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies, where I teach audio storytelling, aka radio and podcasting. And so I'm kind of double dipping here in public radio and this quasi-independent documentary school, which has been around for half a century in Maine. And yeah, I worked for Montana Public Radio for 5 years. I went to the University of Montana's graduate program in environmental journalism. While I was there, I started working at the radio station, getting really involved in Western Montana's environmental justice issues. Eventually moved from Missoula to Butte to kind of track what was going on in real time with this massive, massive Superfund cleanup there. Produced a podcast called Virgis Till, which did all right. and then a couple of years ago, I left the West, moved back East, and now work on a medley of shows at WBUR, which I can talk more about later, and also, yeah, help emerging producers figure out how to tell documentary audio stories. So thanks for being here.
Very cool.
All right, hey. So the clip that y'all are gonna listen to is from episode 3 of the podcast that I guess I'll tell you more about after we listen to the clip, but it is from a member of the Ramapo Lenape tribe in New Jersey, and he is talking about contamination, paint sludge caused by the Ford Motor Company, so.
The one yard where they came, a kid was sitting, banging on something, playing with his trucks. Well, what he was banging on was a giant piece of sludge. Lid. Another yard, kids where I was swinging on a swing set. All around that yard, the swing set was all protruding through the ground, chunks of lead. It's all Fords. And that was supposed to be all cleaned up.
Many of Upper Ringwood's residents say contamination from the paint sludge has made them sick. There are cases of skin rashes, severe headaches, bleeding from the eyes, nose, and throat, and various cancers. So many people have cancer, Val says, that locals call Van Dunk Lane Cancer Row. It earned the grim nickname because each house on the street has been impacted by cancer in one way, shape, or form. When Val's nephew, Colin, died from a rare form of cancer in 2001, that's when locals really started to notice how widespread the health issues were in Upper Ringwood.
My nephew, my brother's son, developed, it was called Ewing sarcoma when he was 10. And he developed that, and that's how everything started. He died a year later. He lived for 1 year from the time that he developed it. And then after that, it was like everybody started getting cancer.
Yeah.
That's the same cancer all the kids in the fracking areas were getting.
It's terrifying. So yeah, that was from, like I said, episode 3 of a podcast that I created and host, and actually I'm not gonna put him on the spot, but my producing partner and the reason why the show exists at NJ Spotlight News, the news division of NJPBS, he's in the audience, so thanks, Michael. Yes, there you go. But it's called Hazard NJ for Hazard New Jersey, and the show, the first season looks at the impacts of climate change on hazardous Superfund sites in the state of New Jersey. New Jersey has the most Superfund sites out of any state in the country. It was 114, and during the first season, we got the 115th. I live in New York, I'm from Texas, and I do a podcast about New Jersey, and I would just want to be clear, I am not from New Jersey, but I have learned a lot about the state, and I appreciate the state, and I enjoy going there and doing reporting and getting the voices out about these stories. So thanks again for coming. Yeah, we'll talk soon.
Bogarting the mics there. All right. I'm Ashley Ahern. I am an independent podcast producer and radio freelancer, and I worked for NPR for 15 years and at member station KOW in Seattle, and then
quit and started my own production company and have been lucky enough to partner with Boise State Public Radio, our awesome host for this whole amazing conference. And I'm working on my third podcast series for them. So this is from my first series for them, which I made right after I left KOW and moved to the other side of Washington State, to a very rural, more conservative county, and got the idea to make a whole podcast about sage-grouse. So this tape is from the final episode. You should still listen to the series, but it kind of builds to this moment of finally being out on a lek, a mating site where the birds are doing their dances. I'm hunkered down in a blind in the freezing cold. There are coyotes singing in the distance, and all around me, finally, are sage-grouse. Dozens of them, the males all puffed up and fighting one another, their exquisite feathers fanned out like spikes behind them, the females cruising along for mates. I've got my microphone sticking out from under the blind, and the birds are strutting by in full display, just inches away from it, totally oblivious. So I think we should jump right in to maybe a different question. Let's start with one of my favorites. So real quick, I think we should go, we'll chat, it's 11 o'clock now. We'll chat for 20 minutes and then we'll open it up. So we'll have at least 25 minutes for all your questions. And I really want this to be a conversation because my goal was to talk shop with these awesome ladies and then talk shop with everybody out here who's trying to do this thing too. Okay, podcasting, the medium, is so different from radio. You were talking about kind of being a refugee to podcasting after all that tape wouldn't get used. What is it about this medium that has either advanced your storytelling, deepened your storytelling, or changed your journalism? And don't feel like each of us has to speak to every single question here, but you jump in.
Nora, you
want to?
Yeah, I'll take
crack
at it.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking about this morning. Most of my journalism started in audio, and since then I've been like drifting into print and be like, oh, what am I doing? I'm back in audio. I think for me, what I love about it is like you can see a quote on the page, and there can be ellipses. You don't know what's happening in that ellipses, right? And you can manipulate someone's words on the page, but I was thinking about one story that one of my students is working on. He met with a Penobscot tribal elder in Maine, and the story is about this book of Penobscot folktales that has never been published before in the indigenous language or in English, and it's like the stories are a basket for culture and values. And when my student Jamie asked Carol Dana, the elder, what it was like to be able to share this with her community, and how it felt to revive the language, you know, she starts saying, it made me whole. But in that, there's like seconds of silence where she's just taking a deep breath. You can tell she's holding back tears. And when you listen to that tape, you don't know what's happening. Like, you're like, oh, did the producer mess up? Like, let's leave a gap in the session. No, it's like 5 seconds of Carol just like sitting in her feelings and Jamie sitting there with her. And that, you could never translate that to the page. So I still think, you know, it's the emotions, it's the feelings that come across, and it's being there with someone as they're having them in real time that I just think there's no competition.
Yeah,
That's like almost exactly what I was going to say. I did the first season of Drilled, I went and interviewed all of these like former Exxon scientists that had done climate research for them. And that story had been done in print. And there were documents and like all this evidence and everything. But hearing this one guy, and now I'm kicking myself for not sharing this bit of there was this one guy who like was on the tanker that did research for Exxon in the Arctic as like a postdoc. You know, he was like a young new hire at Exxon, so excited to be doing all this research. And then, you know, he was like, well, you know, like they didn't have funding to continue the research, like no big deal. And then he starts talking through like his sort of growing horror at seeing what the company started to do over time, and like feeling so powerless to do anything about it, and feeling like he should be doing something, but he couldn't do anything. And it, same, like it's like so many pauses, you can hear the catch in his throat. He started to tear up. This is like a 65-year-old man who's very like gruff and, you know, and again, it's like, I had tons of people be like, wow, like I had read that story, but it didn't really like sink in until I heard those people actually tell me those stories. So yeah, to me that's the thing that I'll need next.
I'll make one comment too on that. That for me, one of the reasons why I got into audio was not only as a woman with the idea of the way that women sound and vocal fry and wanting to sort of overcome that, and also my own issues in my community in Texas, thinking that I have a deep voice for a woman or a girl. I just always find like being able, yes, to hear and actually hear someone's accent, their dialect, the way that they, the cadence of their voice, just how important that is. And like also to overcome stereotypes and prejudices and just hearing that, it's just really important. So I just wanted to make that note. It's one of the reasons I got into this.
You have a great voice for the record.
Oh, thank you. Tell my childhood doctor.
And I would just add quickly that Sage Grouse, when I first started making that podcast, a friend of mine who's a journalist, you know, written for High Country News and all kinds of places, she was like, good luck, we've had such a hard time making that story interesting. And I wasn't prepared for how the sound of those birds, you know, you can read all the stories, of the, you know, are they going to be listed, are they not going to be enlisted, you know, listed, and we should be so, you know, worried about this bird and its disappearance. But I led a tour with SEJ members the other day, and we went out and saw a lek. And I started crying again when I heard those birds, because it's the sound that gets me. I can't, and once you hear it, it's that, well, I won't speak for you guys out there, but like it grabs me every time, and it takes me back to that issue, and it makes it real in a way that reading a print piece about it just doesn't, and couldn't, I don't think. I think without that sense of wonder, we don't inspire people to do things about the environment. And so for me, recording that sound was about showing the wonder of this thing. Okay, let's jump. While we have Amy, because she's got to leave a little bit early, I want to talk about, I think probably for a lot of folks in the audience, the questions about distribution. And okay, if you make a thing, you've got an idea, you want to make a podcast, if you make a thing, if you build it, will they come? Who will hear it? How do you get it out in front of people? So I'd love to hear Amy kick that off and then hear from each of us about that journey, because I think we've all had different paths.
Yeah.
Well, let's see, if you make it, will they come? Honestly, I feel like that the answer to that question changes every 6 months in podcasting right now. It's really hard to know. Right now, everyone is like, don't launch a podcast. The industry's tanking. But I feel like that story, you know, we get that story every 6 months or something. I would say that the best way to ensure that you will have some kind of audience for a new podcast is to partner with someone that already has an audience. Another thing that's really important is to make friends with the literally one person at each podcast app that decides what gets featured. It's like a ridiculous gatekeeping thing, and it's becoming increasingly difficult because all of the podcast apps are now making their own podcasts as well. So they're less inclined to promote podcasts that are not being made by them. But there are one, in some cases, two actual humans who make these decisions. And if you can, you know, meet them and talk to them, and I'm happy to share that information. I really hate the fact that it's like guarded so closely and people like charge money for it and whatever. Like, so if anybody wants to email me, amy@ criticalfrequency.org. I'm happy to give you the names of the five people you need to email about your podcast. But it's very clutch. And then the other thing is some of the podcast newsletters can be quite helpful as well. So there again, I have a list if you want, and I'm happy to send it to you. There's maybe a dozen. Jordan knows this. I've sent her my list.
could you talk in a little bit about just building a network of podcasts? So you instead of trying to get on somebody else's platform, you built your own, which I think is really, I just have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah. So I started in about 2017. I was at Reno Public Radio. I made a podcast with a colleague of mine there called Range, and it was the stories of the new American West. At the time, it was like almost all the podcasts were either in LA or New York, and you know, we just didn't feel like sort of Western state stories were getting told. And you know, Reno is just a storyteller's paradise. There's so many like bizarre characters there. And so we started it. The station, like we asked the station if they wanted to support it, and they said no, but you can do it on your own. And then we did, and it was successful. And then they were like, wait, you should do that for us, except we want to change everything and we want to own it, as stations like to do. So we decided that we weren't going to do that. And at the same time, podcasting was like, you know, this was like at the start of its current kind of rise. And things were already starting to get consolidated into the hands of like fewer and fewer companies. That's even more the case now. And you know, not only have we made that podcast, but she and I were helping a few other people make podcasts too. So at the time, it was easier to get attention from the podcast apps as a network than as an individual show. So we sort of just like cobbled together a few shows and called it a network at first. Honestly, that's like, if that was it. It wasn't like, there was no thought beyond that. and then as time went on, I thought, well, now that we have this, and now that as a network, we have relationships with these podcast apps, like we can try to sort of like muscle some space here still for independent creators. And then, you know, do partnerships with other networks as well, which again are like in some cases more interested in doing that with other networks than they are with other shows. So, I wish I had like a great piece of advice around that, but the truth is I sort of just like stumbled into doing it and then really hustled. yeah.
Do you want to speak to this, Jordan? I feel like you've got an interesting distribution situation.
I mean, I think maybe the interesting part of it is that all along that when I had thought about this idea for a show is I wanted to collaborate with a local media outlet. That was very important to me, that I wasn't going to do something like this by myself, and especially with the idea that it would be focused on a state that I had little familiarity with. I didn't want to parachute in on my own either, and I think the show is a lot better by the collaboration with NJ Spotlight News. And with the institutional knowledge that they have. So I think that partnership worked out really well, and and with Hazard and continuing on potentially with other cities or other states, it would be the same kind of model with collaborating with a local media outlet, and specifically public media.
Okay, so a couple more thoughts just to add on. I mean, I think the whole knowing names and people is really important, because in addition to newsletters, if you can wrangle a feed drop or swap, or get someone to recommend your show or tease it on theirs and they have an audience, that's really helpful. I think the data shows like a lot of people find shows from recommendations of shows and hosts they already trust. So like being here and going to some of the other like audio hubs is, I think it's really valuable. And then the other thing I would say is we get at BUR, I don't luckily have to handle a lot of the back-end distribution stuff, but I know we get tons and tons of pitches from people maybe like Jordan who want to partner, or like you and Boise want to partner, and we don't have like a real clear greenlighting process, but but every so often something makes its way through. And yeah, having the support, obviously, of an established and trusted public media outlet can be huge. We're partnering with the Marshall Project right now, with a print journalist who has never done anything audio and is killing it, a story called Violation. And so, yeah, I'd say, like, figure out who's in charge and pitch the crap out of them.
I get a lot of, frankly, young folks who want to get into podcasting and they're like, I want to make a podcast, I want to do what you do. And I don't like being a wet blanket, but the truth is anybody, the blessing and the curse of this industry now is anybody can make a podcast. You can make a podcast on your smartphone. And so, and there are more than a million on iTunes now, or 750,000. I mean, so getting found is a real challenge. And I, you know, I'm open to connecting people with the awesome folks at BSPR, but you're right, Nora, they don't necessarily have a process either for selecting a podcast. And I think the reason they worked with me is because they knew me. And then that just came from 15 years in the industry. So it's kind of doing the hard time. But what I love about the industry now is it's mushrooming, and there's so many different people making successful podcasts that target niche audiences, which is another thing I love about this medium.
Yeah.
Because you can really speak to an interest group on an issue that they care about, and then they will share it with others. So that's been a pretty solid marketing and like spreading the word kind of option.
Yeah.
But yeah, partnering with BSPR has been a really important part for me, because unlike Amy, I hate the self-promotion. I hate that hustle part of it. And
I also hate it.
Right? But you've done it so well. And I just like major kudos for that, because that's kind of how you start getting your stuff out in the world if you don't have an institution backing you. So anyway, I get a lot of, you know, like print outlets that want to make podcasts will contact me, like, can you help us figure this out? I'm like, yeah, sure, but you should know, like, you're gonna have to leverage your platform, because that's your strength, right?
Totally.
Or even I've been suggesting to people more and more, like, look, maybe you could be a limited run series in someone else's feed. Because a lot of times too, like, unless you know what your season 2 and 3 are gonna be, maybe you don't need to be a whole new show. It's a lot of resources and time to launch a whole new show. The other thing I was going to say is that I did actually pitch drills to like every podcast company before I just made it on my own. And they all told me, we just don't think there's an audience for climate narratives. It's like too expensive to make, and it's not going to pay off, and there's not an audience for it, and blah, blah, blah. And so I'm just convinced they're wrong. So I got like a few grants, and I made it in my car at night when my kids were sleeping. And launched it on my own, like, you know, went and found the people at the podcast apps that like handle the promotion stuff and met them at conferences and stuff like that. And we got 1 million downloads in our first season. So I would also say, if people tell you that your idea is bad and you're really convinced that they're wrong, fucking make it. It's not that hard, you can do it. And like, yeah.
I think, we've got about a couple more minutes here, so I think what I'd like to do is talk a little bit more about your process for making a season from beginning to end. How do so you get the idea, something sticks in your craw, and you're like, oh, this is a podcast season or a series or whatever, a new show. What are your next steps? And then if you could also speak to your hiring, like who are your key, if you only have money to hire one person to help you, who is that person, what do they do?
Because
that's how I operate anyway.
Yeah. Let's do Jordan.
Okay. Now, I'd say the one person that I would hire probably be the sound engineer.
Yeah.
Just knowing that somebody who can do it fast and do it really well makes a world of difference for how this show sounds. And since people are listening to it, I want the show to sound as good as it possibly can. And having that sound engineer be consistent as much as possible across the season has been helpful. And also having a sound engineer that come to find out I've worked with in the past after Amy's recommendation, and we're buddies now. So he understands the flexibility of things when like things fall flat and schedules have to change. So the sound engineer, yeah, would be definitely number one.
Yeah.
Someone you can trust.
Tell us about your process. Where does the idea start?
I don't have like a hard and fast process. Like, it's been really nice to be able to collaborate with, you know, NJ Spotlight News and be able to talk to Michael over there and being able to bounce ideas off of each other. So it's not just me feeling like I'm in a silo here, and having someone with institutional knowledge on the ground has been really helpful in bouncing ideas off, you know, but having an idea about what kind of episodes and having like an episode rundown is really helpful. You at least have some sort of roadmap, but I don't like the idea of having to be stuck to a particular production schedule that, like, it's like the Bible, or like having to
have that anxiety around if a deadline isn't made, then the world is going to end.
Yeah.
So I like being flexible with all of that. And also, that's also in terms of the length of a podcast episode. I don't really like the idea of it has to be 30 minutes for every single episode. I think some stories go longer, some are less, and I'm not going to put bad tape in just to make it 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Maybe Amy?
Sure.
Whichever.
Okay. I have like a batshit crazy
Lay on us, people.
I am always reporting stuff all the time, and I never know where any of it's gonna go. And then usually, like 2 years into being on like one story, I'm like, oh, now I see. Now I see who the central character is and where this story is gonna go. So usually, like before I even know what the story is, I have many hours of tape, and then I do a really long storyboarding process with like a lot of post-it notes and. Also, like digital versions of that, because we have I have people that are not where I am that I work on it with. And that goes through probably like 3 iterations, sometimes including like actually making the first episode and then being like, nope, that's not gonna work. The first episode to me is like everything. I feel like I'm the same with print stories. It's like I have to know what the lead is before I can sit down and start to write. I have to know what the first episode is before I can figure out what the rest of a season is gonna be. And then after storyboarding, oftentimes I go out and do more reporting because the storyboarding helps me see where the holes are and like where we're missing a key voice or where we're missing either a key voice in the story or a key voice in the community where it's like, oh, like we can't do this story without hearing from this person who's going to be clearly affected by this. And then we go through, outlining, scripting, edits to the script, rough cut, then more edits, another rough cut, a table read, and then we go into sound design. I don't like to like make our sound designer do anything until we're like, you know, pretty well locked on content. And then fact checking. So actually I would say my one person, I agree, sound engineer for sure. You all heard the sound in my I mean, I need the help. But also, if I could have 1.5 people, a fact checker. Like, I don't understand why, for some reason, a lot of podcasts just never hired fact checkers in the beginning. Now there's been a few scandals, so they've all, like, are starting to realize, oh, if it's, like, not fiction, it should be accurate. but anyway, so yeah, we go through fact checking, legal review, one more round of edits, and then, like, a fine-tuning audio engineering pass.
So how long does it take you, Amy, for a season? How long would you say?
Like once we actually start, at least a year.
A year, okay.
Yeah, and I prefer to have at least like half of the season in the can before we launch so that when we're working on the marketing side, I'm not like knees deep in production as well. Because a lot of that ends up falling on me too. And like, yeah, it sucks to be doing the marketing and the production at the same time. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll speak mostly to Richest Hill. I mean, I do work on a lot of series at WBUR too and some project development, but they're all so different, like it's hard to kind of find any through lines there. But a lot of folks in Montana think like, I just made this as a passion project. It wasn't. I had been reporting on the Superfund cleanup in Butte for a couple years. And there was this sense, especially, you know, Montana Public Radio's headquarters are in Missoula, very different situation from Butte. And there was a sense of like, what is going on in Butte? We want to find out. But no one really had any idea. And so I had been reporting there for a while, and then at the time there was this thing called NPR's Story Lab, which existed, where you could pitch your project, whether you were an indie producer, whatever, a public radio staffer. Now it no longer exists in that form. Like it was basically this contest competition. If you got 3, you could go to the mothership for a week and workshop your story with the experts, right? And So we initially pitched a project that was probably going to be about Bitcoin and Butte, like the digital gold rush. But in fact, there was a lot more going on in the Superfund cleanup than Bitcoin, thank God. And so we got into NPR Story Lab, and we spent a week hashing out this roadmap. And they still have this really great tool online called Project Blueprint, which if you're thinking about doing a series, I highly recommend it. It helps you think through it and like really ask the question, should you be doing a podcast?
Yes.
Is this one episode? So the 10-part limited series. So I recommend that. But then two things we did on Richest Hill that I've never been able to do again, but maybe it may be of interest to you, is first we had a live event to like launch the idea that we were doing this podcast. And by this time I'd already moved to Butte, and about 100 people came out, and we put some questions around this room in a bar and said, like, here's what we're thinking are things we really want to hit in this story, which is about the past, present, and future of the Superfund cleanup in Butte. What do you think is important? And so we gathered a bunch of feedback from that. And then after that, I also had like a little hive mind of people who weren't audio producers, but were kind of represented like different perspectives in Butte. And I went over my, you know, episode outlines with them being like, who am I missing? What am I not getting here? So I only say this because if you are really interested in like living and working and reporting on the community that you're in, I found that to just like be such a good gut check, and also just like a really part of the process. And it took a long ass time. So again, probably not replicable, but yeah, I don't know. I just think like you can do all the storyboarding and road mapping that you want, but unless it's like really grounded in what's happening, then like you're probably a little bit off base. But everything else Amy said about the cut after cut after cut, and I would agree. So if you're not an audio person, like there seems to be sort of a split of like, are you an expert, you know, sound designer and audio engineer and doing the mixing and mastering, or are you more on like the storytelling and reporting and editorial side? And some people can do both things really well. I can't. So I would agree that having an awesome sound engineer would be great. And I would have a halftime co-producer to go in the field with you to like help you figure out what's happening and maybe even to help with the scripting.
I'll talk a little bit about my process. Each one of my series takes about a year to make, and so my husband's always like, you must be really interested in this if you're going to sign on for another one. And the other thing that we talk about is you have to finish the one you're working on before you can start the next one. So right now I'm making one about wild horses. It'll be an 8-part series coming out in November about that issue. I'm going deep, and I'm already expecting death threats, so say prayers for me. But that's the kind of story that I think needs that kind of storytelling around it, that issue. And my process is, I would say, probably a lot of scattered Google Docs with interesting conversations that get noted, and then I start to coalesce those ideas into buckets. So an episode about ranchers and their feelings about wild horses, an episode about game ecologists in Nevada about their, you know, what the rangelands look like with too many horses on them. Just kind of thinking in terms of almost like a topic, and that's sort of how I approached the Grouse podcast as well. You can sort of hear there's like a natural gas or a gas, you know, episode and a rancher episode, and that kind of helps organize. But then in terms of the production, I have an amazing sound designer, and honestly, even when I was at KOW and this member station didn't know what really how to make podcasts, when I started making a podcast in partnership with NPR, the mothership, as Nora called it, I insisted on hiring an independent sound designer because we had great engineers who knew how to run the boards and get radio on the air, but what, even with that Grouse snippet, you heard the subtle music underneath it. That's this woman, Liza Yeager. She works for Invisibilia. She's amazing. And I hired her to do my sound design, and she makes my stuff better. But that said, I also know how to work Pro Tools. I send her all the cuts. I line up everything. So all she's doing is the scoring, but I deal with all of the grunt work of finding the cuts. And that saves me a lot of money, and it saves her a lot of time. So that'd be one cost-saving option for folks who are thinking about it, but it's well worth the money, I would say. And then in terms of, we do Google Docs, editing in a Google Doc. I hire an editor as well, and so working the Google Docs several times over, read-throughs for time, and then, like Amy, I don't send it to sound design until I'm pretty locked in on the language. But where did the ideas come from? Oh man, I was at the Basque Museum 2 days ago, and I was like, learning about immigration and how it stopped with the Taylor Grazing Act, and I was like, the Taylor Grazing Act. I want to do a whole podcast series about the Taylor Grazing Act. And I called my husband, and he was like, no. It's like, Mustang comes out in November, stop. I was like, okay, then I'll just start a Google Doc. All right, so let's open it up for questions. Is that cool, you guys? We're going to lose Amy here in a little bit. So if you've got questions for Amy, and would you mind just focusing or jump? Don't be shy about that. Let's jump in and make sure she's here to answer as many of those as possible.
I saw you first.
Okay, thanks. I'm very curious about whether podcasting is a full-time job that pays your bills, or what else you need to do, essentially, to make a complete livelihood while podcasting.
Yes, it is a full-time job that pays the bills, and it also pays two other people's full-time salaries. So our revenue comes from a mix of advertising, subscribers, and grant money. We're not a nonprofit, but we have a fiscal sponsor that enables us to apply for grants. And I am very careful to balance that those revenue streams, because I had the experience early on of a grant funder really trying to dictate what we were covering, and I had to give the check back, and it caused a lot of problems and whatever. So I'm now very, very careful about no one of those revenue streams being too much of, not being dependent on any one of those overly much. But yeah, it does. And we're growing, I'm hiring some reporters internationally right now and applying for more grants and all that stuff. So yeah, it is possible.
Let's take some more questions. I saw you next, so let me just start.
This is probably a pretty basic question, but one that other people might have. Coming from public radio world and the 4-minute stories you guys talked about, what is the mindset, or how do you approach reporting differently when you're looking at doing podcasting? What is the difference in the way you're reporting it, you're thinking about it, you're conceptualizing a story or a podcast platform?
For me, I would say just narrative arc. I'm much more focused on that piece of it than on all of the bits of data and facts that I need for a 4-minute news story. I need all of that stuff too, but the narrative arc is more important. And especially finding ideally one or two really key characters who are gonna be windows into the story. I don't always find that person, and then I have to make it work another way. I would add thinking in scene. So I'm driving to Nevada from here, and you call the ecologist on the phone, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I'll tell you all about it." It's like, no, can we go out and just walk around and maybe see some horses and see some trash landscapes, and that's what brings it to life. So any chance I get to do that,
yeah.
It's
probably tape too. It's good to tape yourself,
kind of tape everything.
Whispering yourself like a freak in a blind tape.
Actually, I was going to ask about that because my name is Mary Miller. I'm a freelance and come from a print world, but also have done a lot of video producing. And I got a grant to do a full year of reporting on the Klamath River Dam removal.
Awesome.
And so I'm going to be writing a bunch of print stories. I'm working with KQED for radio stories. So I'm going to probably be out by myself doing a lot of the interviews and stuff as I'm doing reporting. So I want to get good tape. But I also want to introduce all that sort of natural sound. And I will be in the field. I will be with fishermen and rafters and all that kind of stuff. And your choice to whisper over the, say, was that a spontaneous decision that you made? It sounds like we're hearing the person you're whispering at the same time. That didn't sound like it was done by recording them separately and you. So I'm just curious about, because a river probably doesn't discern well when people are talking, and I'm just kind of trying to figure out how the natural sound and the voice inner records while you're out there.
Okay.
Big thank you to Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
So just quickly, that was a three-ring circus recording scenario, but it was also, I knew, the most important scene of the whole podcast series. So it's the Red Desert of Wyoming, and we got there the night before, the scientist I was with, we set up the blinds in the lek so that we wouldn't disturb the birds, and we went out there before they started their display. And I had my iPhone with the voice memo, so that's a voice memo of me in the blind talking. I had him mic'd up on a lav wireless, and he was whispering in the next blind over. And also, this is during COVID, which added a really nice layer of like safety and stuff. But fortunately, we were in different blinds. And I gave him prompts before the lek began. Like the night before, we were sitting around a campfire, and I, on his phone, I just typed in a bunch of things that I wanted him to speak to while we were watching the birds the next morning. And so I got this amazing tape of him whispering that's also in the episode. And then I had my shotgun microphone with the big wind thing literally sticking out from under the blind, and the birds were practically mating on top of it. And so I got minutes and minutes and minutes of that sound in the clear where I wasn't speaking, so I had a lot to play with. And that is the, I mean, for folks who know this already, you know, maybe this is obvious, but the single biggest mistake that when I teach people how to make podcasts, it's not gathering enough ambient sound without you talking over it, without the scientist talking over it. And so that, I had a lot to play with there, and I honestly, even listening to it today, I'm like, gosh, I should have let the birds go longer without me talking over it, maybe, but again, that's subjective, and all we have is our taste, as Ira Glass told me a long time ago, and I really lived by that.
Let's go you. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks, Ashley. Yeah, what a great panel. I'm Lisa Palmer. I'm an author. Actually, Nora and I are roommates. I haven't met yet. like 1:30. I wanted just to say, you know, I'm an author of a book called Hot Hungry Planet. I'm going to be doing more work on that. I've got a couple of more books I'm working on, in addition to my journalism articles about this. So, but I want to and I've always done some, you know, podcasting and videos and so on. I'm looking at finding ways to sort of do that in terms of either more episodes or shorter pieces. I don't feel like I can devote enough time, but maybe I can outsource some of it, a lot of it, to be able to do that. So how can I create more of a suite of media around this because of my book and the articles and a podcast to sort of all be able to, I guess, create a clearer picture for a lot of different types of audiences?
Great question. We didn't answer the question about making a living doing this. So maybe we could speak to that because some of my clients are folks like you that are like, I have the book, I have the thing. Can you help me figure out the narrative structure of a podcast around it? And so I'll help with the editing. And this isn't a pitch to like work for you, but there are people who you should think about outsourcing.
Yeah, exactly.
You should think about it, because if you don't think this way, it's better to hire somebody else who does, because you think you're an amazing author, right? And that's, you know, your print background is so strong that finding the right partner is really key. So that'd be my first line of advice, but yeah, jump in.
No, I was just gonna say, your intention for wanting to do these different things and being clear that what do you want to come out of these different avenues, and how different is it going to be? Is the podcast gonna be just a rehash of the book? Or how do you differentiate these things? And who exactly do you want your audience to be for these things, and for what purpose are they going to serve, is what I tell people too. It's like being really intentional about why you want to do this, because it does cost money, it does cost, you know, time, and even if you outsource, you're still going to have to be talking to these folks, so just, that would be my advice.
Yeah, I think it's tricky in a setting like this where we're just using the term, like the word podcast, like very generally. In my mind, a podcast is as big and broad as the category of books. Like, it's just a way that you listen to something on demand, right? So I think it's maybe helpful when you're thinking about how to go forward, and for other folks who are thinking about different mediums, like what kind of audio experience do you want to create and do you want listeners to experience? Like, a lot of us have done very, you know, intensive, long-term, long-form, narrative, limited run series, which are like, you know, sound rich and deeply reported and personal. And that is like, that's like over here. That's like very high up, I think. I'm not saying like necessarily quality-wise, but just effort-wise. Whereas, you know, there's chatcasts, there's interviews, obviously, and there's audiobooks, and there's everything in between. So I think thinking about not, you know, just like what it would be different for listeners versus the reading experience. And I think that translates to like anything anyone's doing in audio. Like, why are you making it with sound? I'll stop there.
More questions. We have a lot, I think. Yeah.
back. Let me make sure it's recorded.
So we need to have lunch because I have a perfect, like, we need to talk about this because I also just finished a book. It's not an environmental book, it's a true crime book, but I, along the way, recorded more than 330 some interviews. And my question is actually about workflow, but I wanted to also add that how's it going to be different? The way I'm thinking about mine is that it's going to be about the making of a true crime book and all of the ethical decisions that have to go in, the fact-checking, the conversations about, you know, do I put this in, and the actual, you know, going to the places and with ambient stuff. So I guess my question is, I have 330 interviews, and they're all kind of organized by date. What should I be bracing myself for workflow side of, like, getting the clips to? So I have a podcast partner who's going to then produce it, but how do I envision my workflow for getting them the stuff they need to then produce that podcast?
Oh, can I jump in? So I have the same problem when I come back from all my bucket gathering and filling in terms of hours and hours and hours of tape. I think the analogy I use when I'm teaching people how to make podcasts is, if you go to the grocery store and you're hungry and you don't have a recipe, you're in for really a lot of wasted time wandering on the aisles, glassy-eyed, and buying things you don't need, and probably ending up pretty hangry about the whole experience. If you have a clear idea of your narrative arc and your storyline, then that will help. It's like going to the grocery store with a good list. And that will save you hours in terms of going and finding the tape that you need from all of those interviews that you've had. So my first process when I get back from a reporting trip is each of the people I interviewed gets their own folder, a Google Drive folder. Their audio is organized into one folder, and audio files are put together and then run through. I use Otter AI. All of it's transcribed, right? And then you can do word searches and help find your tape faster. But all of that is just process, but then the shopping list is so important in terms of saving you time.
Can you just say, yeah, audio AI?
Oh, it's called Otter, like the
Otter,
animal. Otter.ai. And it's like Descript is another one that a lot of folks love, probably more than Otter AI, but that was the one I started with, so now I'm used to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's some hackneyed radio advice, like, you know, after you come back from the field, you know, what are the top 3 to 5 things you remember about the interview? Okay, that's probably what's going to go in your story. And obviously it's different if you're doing like not a 5-minute news feature and you're doing a half hour episode, but I still think that kind of stands. Like, another one is, how would you tell the story if you were sitting next to your friend at the bar or over coffee or whatever, kombucha, whatever you like. And I still think that's helpful, because if you're just swimming in stuff, like Ashley said, you don't even know what you're looking for. So I would say, like, even before looking at the stuff, think about what you remember, what stands out to you, and then absolutely, like, so logging tape is what we call it. So it's like taking notes on your tape, and there's a lot of ways to do that. But now these transcription services, so Otter AI, Trint, and Descript are making these so much easier. I haven't yet moved to Descript, but you can both transcribe and edit and collaborate with, like, in this one software. I use Trint a lot, but the keyword searches are like your best friend. Then you start to look at, okay, where does so-and-so talk about what? And then personally, I use a coding system of like dollar signs, like, how good is that tape? And I give it $1 to $5 signs. And then I can like keyword search that too, because then I'm like, oh right, that's the best story about this thing. But if you're going to be working with other people, I think starting with a software where you can collaborate, where you can make comments, where you can highlight stuff, like, that'll save you a lot of steps.
I just, like, one note, though, for folks who maybe are doing more sensitive podcasts, that when I worked on with the Southern Poverty Law Center podcast, we had sensitive interviews where we didn't feel comfortable going through Otter.ai or anything like that and actually hand-transcribe. So I just wanted, like, just flagging that. That there are some issues depending on what interviews you're doing and what you do to your transcript. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to do that.
Hi, thank you so much. I have a background in print, so I haven't done a whole lot of the audio side of things before. And I'm a reporter that sometimes travels with producers. Can you talk a little bit about what, you know, for someone that's getting into the audio side of things, both radio and pod, what are best practices from reporters when working with producers?
I would say, just based on my experiences, and also like I do come from a print background as well, and done like the hybrid thing, is being as communicative as possible. So like the producer themselves being able to speak with you about their process and what is going to happen. And I'm actually working right now with a couple of print reporters too, and talking through like how you ask questions might be different than just if you were doing this for print. And do we want to have the reporter's voice on tape too? And so I think that it falls on both parties to talk through the process and like, what do you actually want to get out of this? And what is the working relationship actually going to be in setting those boundaries, just like any other kind of relationship? But I feel like that is very important before you're actually in the field, especially before you're around anyone that you're interviewing. So yeah, that's would be my advice.
Yeah, I've been my own producer a lot, and I've worked with other producers. And I think if you don't have a lot of background in sound, maybe before you go out in the field, kind of like you would if you were shooting a film, you kind of come up with a shot list, but for sound. And you can talk about how you're both thinking about the story. And I would say if the producer has the audio chops, like, get out of their way, like, let them get what they need to. Let them, you know, pop in to say, hey, can you rephrase that question or move over here? But I think beforehand, just like getting together to talk about, okay, how is this going to be different with someone who knows what they're doing? Like, and being, you know, flexible and responsive is probably best practice.
Yeah, I would just add visualizing before you go out. Like before I go into the field, I will literally lie in bed or sit in my pickup truck as I'm driving out and think about what are the key moments that I need to make sure I get, and what are the most important things that I need to record with in my time with this person. And so if you're working with someone else, that's a really good conversation to have, to say, make sure you're quiet when they start talking about X, or when this machine is doing this, or the fish are being released. That is a really key. We need that audio clean with nobody yapping over it. And I can be a bit aggro about it when people mess with my sound. The only like time I've come close to blows in the field was when I was working with our dear former collaborator, Katie Campbell, who's an amazing videographer. She's at ProPublica now. And her camera was making noise while something really important was happening. We were recording like a fish release or something, and I turned to her and I was like, you need to shut that thing off or get the hell away from me. And we're still friends, don't worry, but that's, you just thinking about that ahead of time, a quick conversation would have avoided that whole thing, right? She could have silenced or whatever, you know? So get ahead of it.
So that was actually a good segue. My question is about audio quality and making sure you get good audio quality. So I work with a lot of people who help give podcast interviews. I work with The Economist, and we're based in downtown DC, so a lot of these interviews happen over the phone. And so I'm just wondering what you do, and by extension, what I can do to help make sure that you all get really good phone audio quality.
Never. just don't use phones. I mean, seriously, we have the internet now. So I use Zencaster for when I record, but people were recording on Zoom during the pandemic. I don't know. There's so many better ways. If they could just be in front of a computer and send a link to the guest, it's just a no-brainer at this point, I think. The days of phone tape are just, I think, long gone.
Yeah, we do a lot of that at WBUR, and of course, it really depends. Like, if you're talking to people in rural areas with shitty internet, think about that. But even if...
DC, you're fine.
Yeah, DC, you're fine. But I would add, we use Riverside.fm at WBUR because it records locally onto the person's computer and doesn't just, it's not just over the internet. We can talk more about that. But another trick is, like, if you can get them to have two phones, so one, whether it's a landline or smartphone, and then every single phone, Android or iPhone, has a voice memo recording app. So can I borrow your phone for a sec? Pretend this is a phone and I'm talking to you. This is like, you know, oldest trick in the book. You have them record a voice memo of themselves talking, so essentially they're doing their own tape sync. And then that audio quality can often be better than just a phone recording. But also hire tape syncers. Like, there are people that do this for a living and will go to the person's house to record them. But yeah, and then if you are doing it over the internet, Zoom, Riverside, Zencaster, whatever, talk to them ahead of time, do a tech check. Wait a second, tech check. Thank you, tech check. Talk to them about what their built-in mic situation is, what kind of headphones they have, do they have any recording equipment at home they're already comfortable with, can they use that to do a local recording?
I do just want to add too that lately I've been getting more into Google Voice phone interviews, and what I have set up though is I have a program called Loopback, but it's also similar to like Audio Hijack that you can download, and I think Audio Hijack is free. Loopback does cost money, but Loopback, you can set it up where it will record anything from your browser, including a Google Voice call, into Adobe Audition, Pro Tools, or anything like that. And I found like that audio quality has been pretty good. I've gotten really lazy though for the audio quality, and just am like, sound engineer, please, please fix some of this.
Basically, all I hear is from you guys, and it's fantastic, are, you know, pretty high level, basically, radio funded things. Can you talk about, I do a Hot Globe Substack, which has a big readership, and then I just record the person. So I wonder if you have some, and then we put that out, sometimes that's more. But I mean, I'd like some low tech tips for, you know, you're miking up somebody with Movu and yourself, and you know somebody like Joe Rogan, who has huge readership, right? And it's basically very simple, and so do other people, Tiabi and Walter Kern, you know, on Substack, millions of people. And so, what are your tips for like the low tech crowd?
Well, you're already doing the right thing in terms of leveraging your platform to reach a lot of listeners, but in terms of making the audio quality better, I have a couple clients that I help them with basically what is the narrative arc of your conversation before you record that interview. So where are you starting the conversation? Where are you, and this is just for a chat podcast, where are you starting the conversation? Where do you end the conversation? What are the points in the middle? And I think that helps them, especially folks who are more from a print background or a book writing background, to just be a little more deliberate and have a roadmap before they start the interview, which makes the editing after the fact a lot easier. And I think it just focuses, so it goes from just like a talky-talky all over the place to like a little bit more of a backbone to it, I guess. Any other thoughts on that? Technically, I mean, I'm not sure I have much tech advice on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the suggestions we offered, I would call them kind of low-tech, because if both of you have internet, these programs we just mentioned, Zencastr, Riverside, Google Voice, right?
Yeah, Google Voice and Audio Hijack, I'm pretty certain, is free that you just download on your computer.
Yep.
I know people like recording QuickTime as well.
Right, so as long as you can send someone a link and they can open it, it's basically an interface for you both to talk to each other. And the quality is decent, but I think like Ashley's saying, like, what's even maybe more paramount is the structure of your conversation for the quality of it.
Yeah. Okay, David.
Thanks. I'm 50 years into freelancing, 2 years into podcasting. Our niche.
Yay, welcome.
Yes, it's the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. So basically our niche is like the other 71% of the planet and the people who work and live and recreate. But my background in radio, I think I'm prejudiced a bit that we started, you know, with 3-4 multiple interviews. Now it's gone down. Me and my co-host Vicky, we basically do an interview. And now, and we were keeping it free form to like, you know, 20 to 50 minutes, depending on how interesting. Now we're on to our third community radio station, so I'm cutting everything down to 28 minutes. Because we don't know how else to market, because like we're a radio guy, so we're like trying to get. But I realized this is fascinating, and I realized 2 years into it, I've really not talked to other podcasters who are professionals, and getting so much from this. Where do I go to hear other podcasters to get advice? Is there like an exchange? How do I learn more about what I am or am not doing right or wrong?
There are so many resources. Ashley, do you want to jump in?
No, you go.
Okay, so the one that rises to the top of my list is called Transom, transom.org. They used to have workshops. They stopped. They're probably going to do different stuff soon. But on the website is like an incredible archive of articles about approaches, ideas, tech. And then they've also produced this series of podcasts, used to be called How Sound. Now it's called Sound School. And they call it like the backstory to great radio. And yeah, I listen to a lot of it. So they, like the conversations that happen there, it's hosted by Rob Rosenthal. It's been around for a while. They're awesome. And they've been doing a lot to like platform and amplify new producers. One producer, I'm forgetting her name, but they just started putting something out called all here. Yeah, some nods.
Yeah,
A-L-L-H-E-A-R. And it's like this huge updated list of grants, of newsletters, of jobs, of things to listen to, of places to connect. Another big one is AIR, Association for Independence in Radio. If you're not a member, consider joining. They have great workshops and resources all the time. And those are probably my top three, and there's a ton of others.
And I would just add, go to the Third Coast Conference if you can afford it in Chicago. That's where it was founded by Ira Glass, and I've been going since it started. And it's I think it's gotten a little more corporate in more recent years as the podcast industry has matured, but it's still a great place to network and just meet other podcasters.
But it's kind of on pause right now.
Oh, is it? What are they
doing?
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just going to just add, in PR training, I go and they have tons of resources for free online.
Do you have a resource?
Oh, I'm going to start here and then we'll get back to you, okay?
Hey, thanks for this great panel. Daniel Ackerman, independent radio and podcast reporter. My question is about budget, like, especially now that the free money era of podcasting seems to be over. Like, how do you think about putting together a realistic budget for a show, whether it's like a new show or a new season, something that will actually get funded?
Yeah. Oh gosh, the monies. Oh, the monies. No one's feeling very strong about that. Okay, so you want to know the budget of like how much one of these things costs?
No, or... like how do you think about putting together a budget when you have a vision for a season or a series, but you want it to actually get funded? Like, where do you make? You want $1 million, obviously, but where do you actually put together a realistic budget? What factors do you consider in that?
Gosh, I mean, yeah, I'd be happy to. I didn't really prepare for that. I should have put together, or I'd be happy to share a budget, but I don't know. I'll just tell you the budget for the stuff I made for BSPR. It's not a secret. It's $2,000 an episode for me to have my sound designer do what she does. I pay my editor $2,000 an episode. My travel budget for a whole series is, depending on the travel, it's at least $6,000, but I sleep out of the back of my truck, so it's mostly going for gas and food. Then there's the budget item for what else? Yeah, I pretend that I pay myself. It probably works out to 50 cents an hour when I do the math. and I paid for a chunk of my funding comes from grants. And then BSPR pays me per episode, and that's changed as I've made more for them and they've realized the value of the content. So they pay me better than they did in the beginning. But it was basically like didn't even break even when I first started making stuff for them. But I would say in general, if you're freelancing and making podcast episodes, and Nora, you maybe know the going rate, but I won't make an episode for less than $3,000 for an outlet.
Yeah, I'd say that that's what you should be shooting for. If you're experienced, I'd say like $2,000 to $3,000 is the market rate. But also, I mean, in our line items at WBUR, you know, we have a chunk dedicated to marketing and promotion. I don't know how much, and it's not my job, but not my job. But yeah, I mean, especially if you don't have a built-in audience, like, how are you going to do that? And I think for budgeting, thinking about what are things you're good at and want to do, and what are things you don't want to do. So, do you want to pay a sound designer? Do you want to pay someone to get it out there? Like, I don't know. I think in some of our shows, the new ones in development, you know, we were pitching foundations for $100,000 or $200,000 to do a new season with, you know, a lot of staff involved, but you should be advocating to make a living wage. Like, there's no excuse to not earn a living doing this.
I also just want to add to when you're thinking about a budget, I think some line items that people gloss over is, so if you're creating a new show from scratch and trying to brand and that identity for the show, thinking about a logo and how much are you going to pay a person to be able to create that logo. Also, a trailer. So animated trailers have been really popular, and we did an animated trailer. How much is it going to cost to hire an animator to do that? Also, awards. Are you going to submit the show for awards, and that costs money too? So just thinking through those other more fringy items that I think are really important to add to your budget, but people gloss over.
And actually, I should add, for the Women's Work series I just finished about women ranchers, I hired a photographer for the first time, and she came out to a couple ranches with me, and not all of the things I couldn't afford her, but the ones that she did, she got really beautiful photographs that helped so much with the social media promotion of the thing, and all the brochures and fundraising and pitch docs that we had to, you know, produce afterward. But she also got a bunch of photos of me doing what I do, and it's weird how that played better on social media. Like, I didn't ask her to do that. She just snapped, you know, me on horseback holding a microphone, and I get more mileage out of that photo for bios or whatever else than I ever would have thought I would. So if you do that, think about the promotion of, like, when you're hosting a podcast, people want to know who you are too, and it's not necessarily an anonymous thing anymore, like NPR taught me.
Hi, I have a kind of a distribution related question. I'm wondering if anybody has tried to create curriculum, share any of these podcasts with schools at any level, and if so, you know, what advice would you have around that?
That's my dream. Like, I thought from like day one for Hazard that eventually that would be something, and I am not quite there yet, but what I'm trying to do and what I like sent emails and tried to connect with other with professors and academics to see like if there is any way to incorporate that. So yeah, if anybody else had advice about it, that's a dream of mine.
I would add Grouse. I know it has this weird, like, huge following in academic circles and science teachers, high school science teachers, and the one feedback I get, though, is they wish I didn't swear so much.
That's why the students like it. So,
note to self. Go
ahead. Yeah, I mean, Richest Hill, like, it's been used in everything from high school to college classrooms, but the teachers all came to me because I wasn't, like, trying to promote it. In fact, one high school in Deer Lodge, which is down the road from where Butte, Montana is, they made their own podcast called Rich's Tailings, talking about the Superfund cleanup down in their neck of the woods. So yeah, I don't know, but I think that's especially if you're doing something that, yeah, is like story based but about science and environment, that is like a huge, there's so much desire for that. So maybe getting in on the front end to talk to the teachers about, okay, are there standards that you might want to meet and have this filled in? That's pretty obvious.
I love that idea. Great question. Yeah. We have time for one more. I'm sorry, actually, I forgot to come back to you.
Hi, my name is Austin Gaffney. I'm an independent journalist in Kentucky, and I had a question about pitching. I primarily do print long form. Is pitching similar for a podcast in the sense that you write it out, or do you include audio, or what does that process look like?
That's a great question, and I think one thing that I work on personally is operating from a place of abundance instead of scarcity. And I think in the podcast world, once you have a relationship with a distributor, people are kind of cagey about sharing that. And I just feel like the first step is to get a human being to be able to talk to at some of these distribution outlets. And that happens through friends or experience or connections. But then what I'll do is I make a two-pager, just like I think in the corporate world, you make a deck or a two-pager. And it usually has a nice photo on the top, and it has the tagline of the show, and then it has a paragraph description of what the show is, and then it says, you know, who am I, the host, a couple of sample episodes, and a budget. And that fits usually just onto two pages, and on the bio of my sound designer and editor, so that they know it's a legit team of people that they're funding. And then that's usually that. I get a lot of that goes to the station, that goes to potential funders, it goes to the philanthropists that I, you know, ask for dollars. Yeah, so that's step one for me.
I put a pitch deck together for the Hazard podcast, and that helped me also to figure out what it was I wanted to accomplish with the show. And so I already had a logo with it, and that was on the front page, and I had information about potential episodes, the summary of the show, and then my bio, my contact information. But, you know, a couple page pitch deck and a PDF that I had shared. But I just find that really helpful, having that all lined out. But yeah, we also did, like, I put together a two pager as well too.
Was there audio? I actually don't share audio when I'm pitching.
No, and I had zero audio, but yeah, I wasn't gonna share.
I mean, it kind of runs the gamut, because at BUR we took a pitch, we're not producing the show currently, but from a writer who had 10 years of tape with her father, the Lobsterman. But she wasn't an audio producer, so she included like a 7-minute sizzle reel. But I think it depends if you're pitching a series or just like an episode. If you're just pitching an episode to a podcast, you know, I would think that if you don't have a lot of experience in audio, you can make that clear in the pitch. And there are options within every show to pair you up with a producer for you to say, like, here's what I know how to do, here's what I don't. If you don't have audio reporting experience, like, just, I would say, own that. Like, don't try to fake it. And if you are a reporter, that's what matters. Like, you can sort of figure out the audio piece for these shows, have people that they can pair you with. So I'd say, like, don't let that be a deterrent. But also, if you're like, want merging into this field and you do have a clip and you don't have a proven track record, send it. It can't hurt.
And then making a trailer is the hardest part of every series for me, and unfortunately, everyone wants to hear that soon, and I won't because I don't have the best tape until I come back from a lot of the reporting, and so the series I'm working on now will come out in November. I'll probably have a trailer ready maybe in August, September, maybe. So, thank you all so much for coming, and we're around.